It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to The Lines Between Us, our year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. If you're of a certain age, you may remember taking tests in school that put you on a certain track. Some students were grouped in classes aimed at moving them directly into work, others into college. But that way of tracking students lost support in the 1980s and early 90s in the U.S. after researchers concluded it created divisions based on race and class and perpetuated inequality. Tracking is a controversial word among educators, but it's still being practiced in some schools in modified form, and grouping kids by academic ability within classrooms is even more common. What does it look like in Maryland? We gathered several experts to speak with us about it. Two assistant superintendents of the Baltimore County Public Schools join me in the studio, Penelope Martin Knox, who oversees a group of middle schools there, and Karen Blannard, who oversees a group of elementary schools. With us by phone was Henry Johnson, assistant superintendent for instruction, curriculum, and assessment in the Maryland State Department of Education. And on the line from Boulder, Colorado, was Kevin Wellner, professor of education at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He directs the National Education Policy Center. I asked Professor Wellner, why was tracking used in the first place?
It was originally brought in for two reasons. One is just basic efficiency ideas. So if you think of the idea of assembly lines and putting different needs along different assembly lines for an efficiency purpose. So, you know, the person at the first slot does one thing, the person in the next slot does the next thing. And you have the widgets moving along, and each widget is the same at each step. So it's a very efficient idea. And so if you think of kids as those widgets, if we could figure out the differences between those kids and put them onto different assembly lines, we could be very efficient. The other reason is a little bit more nefarious, and that's simply that when immigrants came from Southern and Eastern Europe initially, and then later immigrants from other parts of the world, they were thought to be less educable, less likely to go to college, less likely to have professional careers, and more likely to be disruptive to the kids who we thought should be educated, which were white and at one point male students.
Well, I was going to ask you the arguments against tracking, and you've sort of led us right up to one. Would you summarize the arguments against tracking?
Well, in addition to the discrimination issues, the empirical research, the evidence of what's happened in the past, has shown us that if a child is placed in a low-track class, they tend to fall further and further behind. In fact, some research shows that they lose IQ points. And so it's just poor pedagogical practice when we know how to engage students, when we know how to challenge students, to ration that, to not provide that to some students.
I have the sense that tracking seems to mean different things in different settings to different people. Tell us about some of the related practices that a conversation about tracking may touch on.
Well, part of this just gets into vocabulary issues. So some people will speak about tracking overseas. The term streaming is used. Here we oftentimes use the term ability grouping. So part of it is just pure questions of what words we want to use. It's really best to get down into a description of what's going on in any given school to think about how that can be improved upon.
Okay, let me do that. And let me start with Penelope Martin Knox. Are there tracks at the middle schools you oversee in Baltimore County?
Within Baltimore County, we do not track students. We utilize data to monitor student success and achievement. And within the data that we've analyzed, we modify instruction to meet the needs of the children. But using the terminology tracking, we do not track or label students in terms of classroom placement.
And the idea of ability grouping, that's also not something I'd find in Baltimore County?
You will find students placed based on their performance levels, which also is a part of their ability. So if we're looking at students who are identified early on in the elementary or within the middle school as being gifted and talented, that would be a form of ability grouping. But in terms of labeling students and tracking them, we do not track students.
So is there a gifted and talented program?
Yes, we offer gifted and talented for our students, and it's actually built in within the curriculum. The curriculum is the standard curriculum as identified by the state of Maryland, and within those courses that are identified as gifted and talented, the instruction is more rigorous for those students because they are accelerating at a different rate than their peers.
We reached out to Baltimore City Public Schools, and they did not make anyone available to talk with us, but they did provide us with a statement which began, quote, "Baltimore City Public Schools
does not advocate tracking in terms of ability grouping for classroom assignments. Instead, we use student performance data to closely follow student progress throughout the school year to guide teachers in organizing small student group instruction within the classroom, end quote. Karen Blenard, I'm trying to understand this concept of ability grouping. How widespread is it in elementary schools in Baltimore County?
Well, at the elementary level, we do know that students come in with varying skill sets. And so teachers have been trained and the curriculum has been developed to really take a look at what are the strengths of the students as they enter our school system, and then what are some of those learning needs. And through the curriculum, we do have opportunities for flexible grouping every single day. So, for example, in reading and language arts, the teacher may be working on a skill, let's say its main idea of a text selection. And so as the teacher models that skill, embedded right in the curriculum is an opportunity for differentiation. So the teacher may decide to pull a scaffolded group where she will be providing some supports with skill development to help students attain the concept. There may also be an enrichment group that she pulls where she's taking that skill to maybe a more complex level, looking at multiple main ideas within a text selection. And then we also have the accelerated pathway, which would be for students that are really demonstrating that deep understanding that we want to stretch their knowledge even farther.
I'm struck by, you seem to emphasize the phrase every day. How flexible is this? Is a child who might be in one of those groups one day likely to be in another one, or possible to be in another one a week later?
It's very flexible because it's based on the concept that is being covered in the content. So we do not say, you know, we've conducted this pre-assessment and you're at this place and you stay in this group for the next 3 weeks. It is flexible based upon the teacher's objective for that lesson and what the students are demonstrating as far as their skill set.
Henry Johnson, what is the state's perspective on ability grouping?
Well, the state really doesn't have a position on ability grouping. That's primarily a local control issue. The local districts have the right to organize their classrooms and organize their instruction according to the curriculum that they design.
Penelope Martin Knox, I mean, one of the things I was trying to understand when we talked a minute ago about gifted and talented is you said you don't want to label students, but if a child picks up that he is considered gifted and talented or that she's not, how is that not labeling?
We're actually identifying the students' levels of achievement and how they're performing in a classroom. All of our students receive rigorous instruction, but there are students who accelerate a little faster than others. And not labeling students, meaning I'm identifying you in a particular category, and that's where you will remain. When I listen to the term tracking, I'm looking at putting a label on a student, and that's where he or she will remain for their career as a student within a school system. When we are looking at identifying students to make sure we're meeting their needs with an all means all approach, that's the concept that we convey to our principals to make sure that teachers are modifying their instruction to meet the needs of children. So if we may have a student who is identified as gifted and talented but may not be gifted and talented in all their content areas, we will provide access for those students. For example, if a student is gifted and talented in English but may not demonstrate such in math and science, that student will have access to a more rigorous, challenging curriculum to meet their needs.
On WIPR, this is The Lines Between Us. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Penelope Martin Knox and Karen Blanard, both assistant superintendents in the Baltimore County Public Schools, also with Kevin Wellner, director of the National Education Policy Center, and Henry Johnson, assistant state superintendent for instruction, curriculum, and assessment in the Maryland Department of Education. Kevin Wellner, when there is grouping, or and obviously tracking isn't seen here in Maryland, but where there is tracking, does it work out that the high achieving students get most of the attention, or does it work out, I've read the other way, that because of No Child Left Behind, teachers might focus on the low achieving students in hopes of making sure they'll pass the standardized test and assume that the high achieving kids will get there on their own?
Well, the No Child Left Behind issue largely was about what we called bubble kids, kids who were right next to the proficiency levels, which were extremely important in terms of making adequate yearly progress. But that did lead sometimes to the neglect of children who were more expert, who were further advanced. So that has long been a problem, with or without No Child Left Behind. There are kids who, at the high levels, in addition to at the low levels, and many in the middle, have been neglected, depending on how the school is structured or how a given classroom is structured. By the way, I'm sure there's plenty of tracking throughout Maryland. I think that Dr. Johnson would probably confirm that. The different reporting that takes place depending on how the question is asked will change the percentages you come up with, but there's tracking throughout every state in the U.S. It's still a very common feature of schools.
Dr. Johnson, since your name has been raised, let me ask whether you'd like to address that.
Yes, I would. And the only thing that I can say is that we only track, for example, the information that's provided to us by the school districts. And while, you know, there may be instances that this type of instructional grouping is taking place throughout the state of Maryland, I mean, we're not aware specifically that it's occurring. As I mentioned earlier, the way instructional practices occur at the district level is a local issue, and the state really doesn't get into those practices or how the instruction is delivered, how they group students, or anything of that nature. What we try to do is to provide the framework for curriculum, which they use around the Common Core State Standards, and we also encourage them to use those principles around the Universal Design for Learning when it's necessary to do flexible grouping or anything like that of the students in order to meet the needs of those individual students in the classroom.
Kevin Wellner, there was a move to D-track schools in the 90s. How far does D-tracking go in addressing issues of inequality?
So yes, in the late 1980s and through the early 90s, there was a move. It was centered in only a few places, but there was certainly a national understanding of what the research was saying about the harms of tracking. D-tracking has taken hold in several places around the country, some of which I've studied. And it varies from, I would say, inconsistently successful, I think would probably be the right term, to very successful. And what I mean by inconsistently successful is that you go from classroom to classroom, and a lot of it depends on the buy-in from the teachers. And a lot of it also depends on the supports provided to the teachers from the schools and from the school districts. And part of it also depends on the basic design, because D-tracking isn't simply about making sure that you have mixed ability classrooms and then making sure that you're not separating kids based on perceived ability. But it also depends on making sure that the curriculum and the delivery of that curriculum, the instruction, is at a rigorous level that challenges all kids at an individual level, which is what I'm hearing the people from Baltimore there speaking about. That can be done. A lot of the semantics that we're engaging here around the issues of grouping, there are all sorts of ways to group kids. The within class flexible grouping is pretty far from what we're talking about in terms of tracking. Between class grouping that's evaluated every year, it sounds a lot more like what we think about in terms of tracking. The key thing, the basic understanding that all this devolves to is that people, certainly including children, learn when they have opportunities to learn. And when we place gaps in front of children, when we place obstacles in front of children, we create these opportunity gaps. And tracking is certainly not the only obstacle that we sometimes place in front of children, but it is one that very clearly creates a difficulty for both teachers and students when we're talking about the lower track classes. It creates an obstacle for both teachers and students to have a classroom where children are really being challenged and engaged.
What would you say to parents who say, my child needs to be challenged? Children learn at different paces. I don't want my child held back by children who aren't learning as quickly.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the drivers to maintaining and sometimes even creating tracked structures. I remember a superintendent in a district that I studied referring to gifted education, which was, I think in his district, it was like 20% of the kids were identified as gifted. It was a racially diverse district, and the kids identified as gifted were overwhelmingly white. And he talked about it as, he used the term, the third rail. I cannot touch the gifted program because I will be fired. And the power behind the push for maintaining a more a separate and in some places resembling sort of a private academy track for the more efficacious parents is very powerful. And some of that, as you point out, some of that really arises from genuine concern about making sure that my child is getting that high quality education that I want for him or her. Keep in mind that that children are not the only ones tracked. Teachers are tracked. So the more experienced, more in-demand teachers tend to be in the higher track classes. And so again, as a parent, I'm saying I want my kid not only in a high track class, but I want my kid with that special teacher. And the parents who are most able to make those demands, most powerful in terms of their political voice, their financial voice, and their ability to work the system, those parents tend to be the ones who are already providing better opportunities for their kids. That's all great for those kids. I mean, that's basically my kid. And it's something that I, as a parent, have to do on behalf of my kid. I see it as my obligation. But if I'm then perpetuating and reinforcing and amplifying a system of inequity, maybe I need to step back and say, what more can I do for all the kids who are not having such strong advocates and might not be getting the same resources as my child?
Well, Karen Blannard, you're on the front line overseeing elementary schools, some elementary schools in Baltimore County, and I imagine you get that question. And what do you say?
Well, we really need to demonstrate to parents that we have curriculum in place that is responsive to students' needs. And so what we really want to do is demonstrate for them the critical thinking skills that we're providing for students, the rigorous instruction that's occurring on a daily basis. And so throughout the course of curriculum development, throughout the course of teacher conferences, parents are reassured that the quality of instruction is at the level of rigor that they would like to see. We also really need to make sure that we are addressing any gaps that students may have within a particular grade level. And that occurs through the flexible grouping. So as we're working through a unit of study, we are being very responsive to students' needs along that continuum. And that is the way that we set learning goals and targets at each grade level that support the Common Core State Standards and where we want students to be when they reach middle and high school levels.
Well, I appreciate you all talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin Wellner is director of the National Education Policy Center at the University of Colorado Boulder. Henry Johnson in the Maryland Department of Education is Assistant Superintendent for Instruction, Curriculum, and Assessment. Penelope Martin Knox and Karen Blannard are both Assistant Superintendents in Baltimore County Public Schools. We want to hear your thoughts on tracking and ability grouping. Do you or your kids have experience with it? Leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. That number is also at our series website, linesbetweenus.org, and that's where you can click on the Your Stories tab to share your experience. That website, once again, linesbetweenus.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on The Lines Between Us, a professor on why race is fundamentally a moral issue. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Mornings, The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
On 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to The Lines Between Us. We're talking about education this morning. Lawrence Blum grew up in Baltimore. He's a philosopher on the faculty of the University of Massachusetts, Boston. And for four semesters, he taught a class on race and racism at a high school in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He reflects on that experience in a book called High Schools, Race, and America's Future. Lawrence Blum joins me in the studio. Good morning.
Pleased to be here.
So you taught at a place that your kids actually attended called Cambridge, Ringe, and Latin. What was the course on race and racism about?
So let me just say that the school is a comprehensive school. It's not an exam school, even though it has Latin in the name. It drew from all parts of the city.
So it's a public school.
It's a regular, big public school, big diverse public school. It was a course about the serious academic study of race as a subject. I wanted the students to see that it was something like chemistry, was something like American history, was something that you didn't necessarily know about. Just because you had experiences that related to your racial identity, that's not the same as knowing where the idea of race came from, how race became such an integral part of American history, how it's different in different countries. I wanted students to have this much bigger picture, both have historical depth and also a comparative framework for understanding race, and they can fit their own experience then into that larger.
And how many kids, and what was the racial makeup of the class?
So it was around 20, and the racial makeup differed from year to year, but I wanted the course to primarily be for Black and Latino students, partly because those students often don't have sufficiently intellectually demanding courses to take. So I wanted to make sure that my course was that. But at the same time, I wanted to have kids from all racial groups. And so the guidance counselors helped me to sort of form a class that generally met those guidelines. Maybe two-thirds of the students were Black and Latino and one-third were Asian and white.
Mm-hmm. And you spend most of your time teaching at the college level. You're a moral philosopher. You've been teaching at UMass Boston for 20-something years. Yeah, a long time. Why teach in a high school? Why offer this class in a high school? Is this the same kind of class that you would offer to your undergraduate college students?
It is somewhat the same, but I didn't have any experience as a high school teacher at all, and I fell into it a little bit by accident, to tell you the truth. But I had been starting to teach in the education program at UMass Boston, and it was starting to feel a little dissonant to me to be teaching people who were going to go into secondary teaching without ever having had any experience of that myself. So when this opportunity kind of presented itself at the high school, I thought, well, you know, it would really be interesting to do, and it would, you know, give me some credibility as somebody who is teaching future teachers as well.
Mm-hmm. You talk a little bit about the rhetoric of race, and that perhaps we shouldn't even use the word race when we speak generally, and perhaps we should use one of your suggestions is to talk about racialized groups instead of race. What do you mean by that? And what does that accomplish?
Well, the concept of race historically has had a lot of genetic and biological baggage. It sort of implies that it's a fundamental division of the human species, that there's tremendously large genetic differences among groups that are called different races. But that's not true. There is not large genetic differences. There are very tiny genetic differences between different racial groups. So that's a reason that some have wanted to throw out the word race or use it with kind of scare quotes around it. And I agree with that, but it's not that easy to do it. And so, you know, this idea of a racialized group sort of emphasizes that people have experiences that are based on these racial ideologies, that some groups were inferior to others, and that has shaped their experience. So race has played a part, the idea of race has played a part in the historical and social experience of all groups in the United States. And that's the idea of a racialized group is meant to highlight that point.
Race is certainly a political issue. It's certainly an economic issue, can be an economic issue. It's a demographic issue. But you, as a moral philosopher, say that it is a moral issue. I think most people, you know, at first glance would agree with that. But what exactly do you mean? What are the moral dimensions of our understanding of race?
Well, I think there are a lot of different moral dimensions. There's there are moral dimensions that come out in interpersonal relations, whether you treat other people with respect or whether race gets in the way of your being able to do that. It also comes in, like some of my students talked about racial incidents that would happen in the school where a member of one racial group would, you know, do something hurtful to a member of another group, and then whether it was right or wrong for other people to sort of intervene. So they saw it as a moral issue about whether you should take some agency in trying to stop racism. But it's also a moral issue on the broader social dimension that your shows are featuring. That is, it's an issue of justice, and justice is a moral issue. And there's so much injustice that still, you know, exists that's so embedded in our historical and social experience. So that's another dimension as well.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to The Lines Between Us. My guest this morning, Lawrence Blum. His latest book is called High Schools, Race, and America's Future. You quote an historian in your book named Audrey Smedley, who says that race is a human invention. When did this notion that white people are superior to non-white people take hold historically?
So this is basically what the course was about, that very question, and Smedley's book gives an answer to that question, sort of traces the history from, basically it went along with European expansion, European colonialism in the new world. It was somewhat different in different places, you know, so like in the English colonies, since the English got into the slave trade a little bit later, the notion of race sort of got going a little bit later than in the Spanish and Portuguese, but it developed very much over time. It took a while for the idea to have all of the features that we associate with it. And, you know, it's a very complex process that went back, you know, basically to the 16th century.
There is some data, and there's certainly a perception about academic achievement and white students versus non-white students. How did this play out in your class? And again, the assumption is that, you know, non-white students are not generally statistically as academically successful as white students. What was your experience in this particular diverse high school in Cambridge, Massachusetts?
Well, I didn't see that gap in my particular class. And, you know, that gap definitely exists on a national level. But I did have students from all different groups, and you couldn't really plot a sort of, you know, the white students were always the better students. That just wasn't the case. There was a mix among all the different groups in terms of the more serious. Actually, almost all the students were pretty serious, but in terms of academic accomplishment, every racial group had some students who were at the top of the class.
So do you think your personal anecdotal experience suggest that some of the statistical data that people toss around all the time about underachieving non-white students should be suspect?
No, I don't really think that one class, you know, there might have been a self-selection dimension to it. I'm not totally happy with that discussion, that kind of achievement gap conversation. I think it often is very narrowly focused on, you know, scores on tests, and it sort of leaves a little bit of the civic and moral dimension of education out. So that's one reason I don't like talk about it. But I don't deny that gap exists, and I don't think my class really, you know, I didn't see it in my class, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
You talk about in the book a study that suggests that black students do homework to please their teacher and white students do homework to please their parents.
Yeah.
I thought that was fascinating. Was that your personal experience in this class?
I didn't really know. You know, the person who did that study was using it to try to say that black students care about their relationship with their teacher. And so it's really important to have a good relationship with black students. And I did make a special effort, you know, partly because I'm white and I needed to bridge that gap. But I really tried to forge a relationship with each individual student in the class. But I was particularly concerned with the black students and you know, trying to get that kind of personal relationship.
As a general rule, what do, I mean, the title of your book is High Schools, Race, and America's Future. What students can teach us about morality, diversity, and community. What can high school students teach us about morality, diversity, and community? Let me answer the question in your title so no one will go out and buy your book.
Well, I mean, one thing I would like your audience to know is that if you set up a course, an academically serious space that's also a respectful and trusting space, these students will rise to the challenge of it. They will talk to one another. They will learn how to have respectful interchange with each other. They'll learn to address each other in ways that show that they're regarding their fellow student as somebody that they can really learn from. And all of this about this incredible minefield of race. I mean, it's thrilling to have students of different races have these constructive conversations about race. You just don't see it very much. Adults don't have it very, very often, and these students really did. So that's something they could teach us about diversity, and then, you know, about morality. There are these very particular conversations we had about, you know, as I mentioned, whether a black student should intervene in an incident with a black and an Asian student. Students were always sort of thinking through what role their own racial identity should have in the rights and wrongs of racial interaction. And I can't summarize the takeaway message from that, but it was quite fascinating.
You bring up this notion of, you know, setting the environment and letting them have these discussions, and that they meet or exceed your expectations when it comes to that sort of thing. You talk a little bit in the book about expectations and what you call accessible potential. How did this play out in your class? What do you think the dynamics there are?
Well, it's sort of a complicated issue, because if you use what students have achieved in other classes to, you know, say, sort them into different tracks or different kinds of classes, the problem is that some student might have a potential that hasn't yet been tapped by the teachers that they've run across, either because the teachers might have too low expectations of them, or, you know, for just whatever quirky reason. So I felt that I was humbled by humbled in the respect that I didn't feel like I could say I really understand what this particular kid's capabilities are. I always felt like there might be something that I'm not getting of this kid, and, you know, I sort of look for other ways to try to get some kids to sort of express themselves in some different fashion. So this idea of accessible potential is like a potential that a student has that hasn't yet been tapped, but it's the responsibility of the teacher to figure out how to do so.
Your book is fascinating, and you've got some really interesting insights, so I'm delighted for the chance to read it, and thanks for taking the time to talk about it.
Thanks very much, Tom. I really enjoyed it.
Lawrence Blum, his latest book is called High Schools, Race, and America's Future. On 88.1, this is The Lines Between Us. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus, or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.